latest through the day. But brightness will be limited across these areas, perhaps parts of southwest England seeing a few glimmers of sunshine. I think it's more likely again, though, across the northeast of England. But even with the cloudy skies, we should still see temperatures staying on the mild side between 8 and 10 degrees. It's Scotland that gets the lion's share, though, of the brighter weather, particularly central and eastern parts of Scotland. Some good spells of sunshine, a little bit more cloud perhaps for western Scotland at times. Temperatures generally here around 6 to 8 degrees. Now, we are going to see a change as we go through Thursday night and into Friday. A cold front's going to sweep across the UK, taking a lot of the cloud with it, but it will start to feel quite a bit colder again in a strong northwesterly wind during Friday, and cold enough, in fact, for some snow over northern hills, particularly through the Scottish mountains. But the high builds back in again for the weekend, so lots of settled weather to come through Saturday and Sunday. Still some reasonable spells of sunshine on Saturday. Cloud beginning to gather once again for Sunday. Temperatures are beginning to bounce back to some extent as well. So that's the forecast. Now back to Alan Smith.
Thank you, Peter. Well, this is Radio 4, and now Henry Goodman continues our Book of the Week. In France, for most of Mitterrand's political career, there was a gentleman's agreement with the press that a politician's private life should remain private. Mitterrand's private life was famously as complicated as his political one. After a broken engagement, his first encounter with the young woman who was to become his wife did not go well.
Danielle was a gauche adolescent whose idea of fun was bicycle rides in the country and romps with her dog Mario. When François teased her, she stammered, blushed, and, as she wrote later, ended up like an offended hedgehog. Nonetheless, by July 1944, they had become engaged.
It was all at 100 miles an hour.
I was a young girl emerging from a protected childhood, and already this man wanted to marry me. I hardly knew anything about him.
The François Mitterrand who married Danielle Gouze was a very different person from the lovelorn young man who'd been rejected by Marie-Louise Terrasse, and he made that brutally clear from the start. At the wedding reception, even before the cake had been cut, he began to look anxiously about him.
I shall have to go. There's a meeting of the Resistance and they're waiting for me.
The scales fell from Danielle's eyes, but she wasn't easily fazed.
I'm going too.
So it was that François joined his resistance colleagues in white tie and tails, accompanied by his wife in her white silk wedding dress, for a rather boring routine meeting. That was how it would be all their lives. He would do as he pleased, she would find a way to deal with it. Mitterrand was more than difficult as a husband. He was often impossible. He demanded absolute freedom and found the slightest constraint intolerable. Not long after the wedding, she asked him brightly when he came home one evening, "How did your day go, darling?" The reply drew blood. "I did not marry you under the regime of the Inquisition." By then, Mitterrand had already embarked on a political career. That summer, de Gaulle had named him a minister in the insurrectional government which was to take power in Paris after the Normandy landings. When the moment came and the city rose against the occupant, Mitterrand took over the War Veterans Ministry, for which he was responsible. André Pernat, a print worker who accompanied him to the commissioner's office, remembers Mitterrand entering with a drawn pistol. He started work as a minister with two boxes of Molotov cocktails on the floor beside his desk. Over the next 14 years, Mitterrand would serve as a minister 11 times. But de Gaulle's return to power in 1958, followed a year later by the Observatory affair, seemed to many to spell the end of his career. His marriage was in trouble too. It had started with François's absences.
"He was not there," Danielle remembered.
If it wasn't work, it was an affair, aided by that redoubtable aphrodisiac that comes with political power. Mitterrand, the shy young student who'd languished under the spell of Marie-Louise Terrasse, had become a formidable king of hearts. Françoise Giroud, an able chronicler of French mores, wrote,
When he unwound, he was irresistible. If he had wanted to, he could have seduced a stone. And he wanted to, often. Women with politics were the great passion of his life.
Daniel had come to terms with his infidelities early on, and there were times when she was able to laugh at them. But there was an emptiness in her life.
Not having anyone to talk to, I lost the taste for conversation. I lived as a recluse. Isolation and withdrawal led me down into a terrifying gulf of antisocial behavior from which I could find no escape.
The shared nightmare of the observatory affair brought her and François back together, but not as they'd been before. In 1958, Daniel had taken a lover. Jean Valency was a gym teacher at a nearby secondary school. They'd met 3 years earlier when he was 19 and she was 31. He remembered, "It happened little by little, imperceptibly. I couldn't even say at what moment it started. It just happened, as these things do." François accepted the relationship. Jean was easygoing, and the Mitterrand sons, Gilbert and Jean-Christophe, adored him. He taught them tennis and took them on skiing holidays.
Daniel explained, "If you are fundamentally attached to each other and you really want to stay together, to live separate lives is not inconceivable."
For his part, François told friends, "I do not see how I can forbid my wife what I allow to myself." At Ossegor, on the Atlantic coast near Biarritz, where the family had a holiday home, Mitterrand could escape from national politics, find solace in literature and play golf. It was here that he met Pierre Pinjot, a well-connected industrialist. The Pinjot's second daughter, Anne, then 14 years old, found him different from anyone they'd met before. The Pinjots were an old-school, upper-middle-class Catholic family from the provinces, who, on her mother's side, were, in Anne's words, a generation behind the times. "My maternal grandfather, a retired general, believed that women should not work, nor should they study. The worst thing a woman could do was to wear glasses and pass the baccalaureate. I was expected to do something decorative and then get married." But by the late 1950s, even in the French countryside, those timeless certainties were beginning to erode. Anne got her baccalaureate and shortly after she turned 18, went to study at the École des Métiers d'Art.
"I discovered Paris. What happiness it was. Freedom."
The first year she was there, François acted as her guardian. She was intelligent, passionate about art, a slim brunette with green eyes, a ready laugh, and an enchanting smile. She captivated him, he charmed her. She said later,
"He was interesting. People like that, who are on a higher level, multiply life for you by their knowledge."
6 years after they'd first met, they fell in love. Anne explained,
"It wasn't at all what was supposed to happen. I had been overwhelmed."
Don Juan had met his match. His friends used to wonder why he didn't seek a divorce. Some thought he feared it would damage his career. Anne had a different explanation.
"Once he'd made a choice, he stuck to it. Daniel was a choice he'd made, and he would not leave her."
In 1965, on holiday at Ossegor, Mitterrand stumbled on a clearing in the pine forests with a wooden house in ruins and a sheepcut nearby. The place, which the locals called Latch, enchanted him. He brought Anne to see it.
"Look, we can make a home for ourselves here." "It was our trysting place," she said.
The owner, an elderly aristocrat, agreed to sell. But the 1965 presidential election intervened before the paperwork was complete. Mitterrand had represented the opposition to de Gaulle. And when he returned the following year, the owner
had changed his mind. He is furious,
the notary told him.
He says that rascal Mitterrand who forced the general into a runoff, he'll never have my pines.
By then, Mitterrand too had changed his plans. Lutch would be home not to Anne, but to Danielle. He'd assumed that, given his wife's relationship with Jean Valency, she'd have no objection. He was wrong. She put her foot down.
Anne said later, "When you're young, you think you are so strong." I'd drawn some designs for the sheepcote. I thought it was for us. What an idiot I was. When something like that happens, you know you're not the one he prefers. That's the hardest thing to accept.
There were other difficulties.
François might have settled down, but he was still, as Anne put it, free. She added, "On my side, I knew I would never be with anyone else. To admire someone so much, never to be bored for a moment, to have the same interests, for us everything was in a state of perpetual renewal. It was 32 years of happiness.
And unhappiness.
Because it was hard, too."
Mitterrand eventually overcame the old baron's reticence.
The simple one-story dwelling at Lutch housed Danielle and the boys. The sheepcot became François' lair, a bedroom, library, and study rolled into one. Because it represented a victory over Anne, Danielle was at pains to assert her rights. It would remain the family home for the rest of her life.
"A place for my children and grandchildren," as she put it. For François, too, it became the sanctum sanctorum of his official family.
Anne had realized early on that since she was determined to spend her life with François and they couldn't marry, she'd have to be independent. On his advice, she decided to become a museum curator. But for that, she required a university degree, so for the next 4 years, she studied law. Between the two rounds of the 1965 election, François sat up one night helping her with an essay.
"When I think of it now, I am ashamed. A candidate for the presidency of the Republic had better things to do than to assist me with my homework about communal law. But he made time, which proves he must have been in love, because you had to be a complete lunatic to do something like that."
3 years later, he bought two small pieces of land at Gordes in Provence, where they built a tiny cottage. But something was missing. In 1973, Anne gave him an ultimatum. She knew she could never be his wife, but she wanted their child. François demurred at first. Anne was adamant. Mazarine Marie, named after the 17th century cardinal, whose breviary was among his pillow books, was born in December 1974. One of their oldest friends called her
a gift that they gave to each other.
For the next 20 years, Mazarine would be the light of Mitterrand's life. Danielle was informed of her birth almost at once by the inevitable well-meaning friend. She absorbed the blow. It didn't really change anything. In Paris, the official family was now ensconced in a 16th century house in the Rue de Bièvre. Danielle had her bedroom on the first floor. Not far away was the room of her partner, Jean Balancy. François' bedroom, lined with books, was on the second floor. The top floor, the pigeon loft, as the family called it, reached by a steep oak staircase, was his office, guarded by a redoubtable secretary ensconced in a cubbyhole by the entrance. In the morning, it was usually Jean who went out to buy croissants and fetch the newspapers. He and François breakfasted together. They all spent the holidays at Lutch. To outsiders, he was introduced as a distant cousin. After Mazarine's birth, the second family took on added importance. Anne bought a small apartment for herself, 10 minutes' walk from the Rue de Bièvre. A few trusted friends were in the couple's confidence, but outside this inner circle, in theory, no one knew.
Henry Goodman has been reading Mitterrand by Philip Short. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions. This is BBC Radio 4. Now here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office. On behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today, Thursday the 28th of November. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Fisher, Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. High Shannon, 1039, slow moving with little change. New low expected Iceland, 1001, by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking. Northwest backing southwest 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 at first, showers, rain later, moderate or good. North Utsira, South Utsira, northeast 40s. Northwesterly 6 to gale 8, decreasing 4 or 5, showers, good. Southwest 40s, Cromarty. North